and then basically march together in a column with clubs and shields and march directly into a crowd of counter-protesters. They claimed that they did that because the police told them to march that way and that they were just following their plan with the police by marching into people that were there opposing them and assaulting them. It came out in this trial that the police didn't tell them to march that way. Maybe there was one conversation where someone from the League of the South said, hey, we're going to march up this street, but the police didn't agree to that.
All righty. Well, this goes on for the whole thing is 38 minutes. If you go to YouTube and just type in Unicorn Riot, it'll be the first thing that comes up. He goes on to delineate the whole tree of relations between all these people and what they're about. I'm going to leave you now. Robert Jones is here, is on tape right now. Peace and social justice, Robert Jones. Thanks a lot. I'll see you next week.
Discovery is another word for basically documents you have to preserve when you're being sued, because that becomes part of the information in the case.
Welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program for Friday, November 19th, 2021. I'm your host today, Robert Jones. On the program, we'll look at last Tuesday's city council meeting and the proposed solutions to the homeless crisis here in Chico with the founder of Chico Friends on the Street. But first up, how do we raise more empathetic children? We'll have a discussion with the senior research and evaluation manager for the Making Caring Common project at Harvard University. We'll learn a little bit about how to raise children, not only that who are empathetic, but who have a sense of social justice. So stick around. Be back in just a second. Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for customer pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And by Quicksilver Courier Service, established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services for private individuals, as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. Welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program today. I'm your host, Robert Jones. I have with me via Zoom, Milena Batanova. Milena is the Senior Research and Evaluation Manager for Making Caring Common. She oversees all evaluation projects, including K-12 schools and families, and she manages research studies involving U.S.-based adults' views on current political and social issues. Milena received her Ph.D. in health behavior and health education from the University of Texas at Austin, where she conducted empirical studies on adolescent empathy and aggression/victimization. She earned a master's degree in communication studies at Arizona State University, where she also worked as a service learning coordinator and lecturer. Milena, welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program.
Aw, thank you so much for having me and for that very nice introduction.
Well, it's such an honor to have you on the program. So the first question I have is, you know, our listeners, most have probably not heard anything about the project. What is the Making Caring Common project at Harvard? What's it all about?
Yeah, so we're actually, we're a relatively small project of the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And by small, I mean, we're, around 5 to 6 people. Our faculty director is Rick Weisbord, who some may have heard. He's published a couple of pretty well-known books, including The Children We Mean to Raise. And that's actually part of the reason I joined MCC, because you know, of what Rick does and what we all aim to do, which is really to help adults help raise caring, good kids. And by good, I mean kids who really care about others and care about the common good. And we do that both by, you know, conducting our own research, but also relying on others' research to develop really thoughtful and developmentally appropriate resources, both for schools and families, to be able to nurture the capacities needed for caring. And we do that, you know, right now, currently, we have four big branches of our work. So it's the schools, right? We develop resources for schools. We also develop resources for families. We seek to integrate those. We also seek to reimagine college admissions. Right now we have this really big three-year research initiative to understand the state of caring in America.
Wow, that's a really noble and amazing project you're involved with. Well, let me ask you just to start off the question. How you know, a lot of people are not clear on exactly what in research when there's research using empathy. I know there's, I think Paul Bloom at Yale does empathy research. What kind of things are you talking about when we talk about teaching empathy? What do we mean by that? What is
Yeah. So in general, right, the definition of empathy is to be able to share, understand, and really truly come to value other people's feelings and perspectives, right? So that's the general definition. But it's quite complicated, right? It's really hard to answer that question in a way because of those different components of empathy, right? So there's this like vicarious aspect to it where you're truly sharing in someone's feelings. There's a more cognitive aspect, which is about perspective taking. And then there's the more affective or what we call ethical, right? Which is really about having concern for people, especially people different from you. We talk a lot about that, the importance of expanding our circles of concern. And then, you know, acting on that concern, right? What we've also termed the empathy action gap. You know, depending on what component we talk about, I think there's like different skills and different approaches. And also, of course, developmental appropriateness, right? Like some of the recommendations we might give for, you know, ways to talk to a two-year-old might be very different than ways you can talk to your 12-year-old. And then, of course, I think, you know, the tripart of this complication is how to then actually help adults foster these habits of caring in ways that are organic and natural and sustained, right? So in like research terms, we call that implementation. Like how do we actually help implement in ways that are sustainable and meaningful and that show like effectiveness over time? And that's actually a big part of my research at MCC is figuring out how to develop strategies that stick, right? That can actually be maintained. Because for the most part, you know, most of us know that to nurture empathy, we really need to be responsive and warm and caring. But how to do that in ways that are meaningful and genuine and consistent, I think can be really, you know, that's the really tricky part in many respects.
Something came to mind as you were talking about, you know, these different phases, implementation and the affect of empathy, and then also putting empathy into action. So I'm wondering, I think a lot of people think that empathy they see it as like an emotional, say it has an affective or an emotional component in response to, say, someone in need or some kind of situation. And I'm imagining that people are thinking, look, it's something, either you got it or you don't. And it seems like, right? So you have this, your entire project here is to say, look, this is something that can be nurtured, or it can be modeled, it can be taught. If you can take me through that kind of thinking. So what is it that, so you can take a person, I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, things like, Pygmalion or My Fair Lady, right? Where it's like, look, I can make a baker a candlestick maker. You just give me the kid and I can mold him. So, so this idea that I can actually take a child and implement this kind of program and nurture feelings in the child that wouldn't be there otherwise. So that's fascinating to me. If you can take me through, like, how does that work? Say something about that.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, MCC does have some concrete strategies on our website for schools and families. But we also have some general tips, and those are what I can kind of go over here, because they were kind of put together out of, you know, a review of the literature, right? And just what we know from so many studies. And so, like, there are five big tips, right? The first one is really empathize with your kid and model empathy, right? Like, so we all know kids are true sponges. They really do kind of pick up on what they see and what they hear. And it is so important that if we want them to be empathic, we have to be empathic as adults, right? In our day-to-day lives. I really think that is perhaps the most important thing. Too often we focus on, like, what can we do to the child, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what can we do in our kids? And I don't know if we think enough about ourselves, right? Like, what do I need to do in order to really instill this quality? And so that means, you know, like, when you empathize with your kid, like, you're really responding to their needs, right? You're asking them questions. You're showing interest. You're waiting for them to talk and to finish a sentence. You're not talking over them or for them, right? There's like a slew of examples or other strategies. So I'd say, like, that's the big one. And then, you know, as part of that, the second tip we give is you really want to make it a priority, right? You really want to make caring a priority, and you want to set high ethical expectations. And this came from, like, earlier research done at MCC before me, I will say. I didn't come up with this great design, but what they did was, you know, they asked kids and parents alike, like, how they would prioritize caring, achievement, happiness, right? And so while parents might say that they prioritize caring, they don't prioritize it as much as happiness. But kids are also saying that their parents are not prioritizing caring, right? They're saying parents are prioritizing achievement, then happiness, then caring. Recently we've seen some, shifts in that data where, like, more and more parents are prioritizing happiness, then caring, then achievement. So that's positive. But in general, I would say there is still this tendency to undermine caring, right? And to just kind of look at happiness first and the importance of ourselves and, like, you know, our needs and our goals, right? So I think if we really want empathic kids and we really model that behavior or that feeling, then it's also important that we be consistent in the message we give off, right? So it's not just that it's important to be happy and caring, right? The two don't have to be exclusive. And then the third tip we give related to that is provide opportunities, right? For kids, but also for your family and friends to do caring things, right? Like, kids need role models as much as they need good opportunities to be able to enact the things that we're modeling, right? So, you know, I don't think it has to be, you know, as big as, you know, a big volunteering gig for years to come, but of course that'd be great. I think that'd be wonderful. But, you know, if people are saying they're strapped for time or, or, you know, they're still nervous, you know, understandably, to do things in person. I think there's just lots of different little opportunities, right? Like I was at the playground with my kid the other day and we saw a bunch of trash everywhere. So, you know what I did? I was like, hey, Luke, let's clean up the playground. And we literally went, picked up all the trash and threw it in the bin. And, you know, I would hope that he picks up on that behavior, is like understanding that that's like a social form of empathy, right? That's like caring for our environment. And then the fourth tip we give is to really expand kids' circles of concern. And again, that means expanding our own circles of concern. And what we mean by that is that, you know, it's much easier for us, or it's often easier for us, to empathize with people who look like us or who are somehow familiar, right? And we know that from a slew of studies in social psychology, you name it. What's important is that we also really stretch ourselves, right, to want to understand and feel for others, however they might be different, you know, whether that be in culture, race, economic background, gender, you name it. And then lastly, you know, this actually, I don't know if this gets talked about enough, is the importance of self-control, right, and regulation. Because it's all too easy when we feel empathy, and especially for some of us who are like deep empaths, like myself, it can be so distressing, right? When you feel so much for someone and you either don't know how to help, or you don't know how to help yourself in that moment, that you know how to regulate your feelings. And only when you're able to regulate can you really then truly, you know, translate that concern into positive action as opposed to negative. So I know that was a lot, but those are like our main five tips that I think do a really great job of summarizing a lot of good research out there.
That's great. That's a great summary. My guest today is Milena Batanova. She is a senior research and evaluation manager for the Making Caring Common project at Harvard University. And we're talking about basically, you know, how to raise more empathetic, caring children, and sounds like starting with parents being more caring. Now, Milena, there's a couple. You've raised some great points, and I have some questions. So, first of all, this idea that you have achievement, caring, and happiness, and of course, you mentioned that it seems like most parents emphasize with their children, you know, the achievement aspect, the happiness aspect, and maybe the caring aspect comes last. And, you know, it seems like an uphill battle. Maybe I'm just old and cynical here, but it seems like the culture, our culture, at least in American culture, right? We don't emphasize things like caring. We emphasize things like achievement. And so you're raising a child in a culture that valorizes, you know, I mean, on one extreme, you have the Ayn Randian, you know, those the self-interest, maximizing self-interest is what makes a great society, which by all, you know, all data, that's obviously false. But those are the conditions under which we're raising children. Mm-hmm. So that seems to be first. That's a challenge that you're talking about, emphasizing the caring aspect. And maybe it might not even be that you have to put the caring aspect first. I mean, I think it'd be a wonderful thing, but some kind of balance. And there's there's this critique of education where it's a very common, you know, it's a kind of a hackneyed critique. We're like, well, we're coddling children too much, and we have to be more self-reliant.
Yeah.
So how do you overcome something like, I can imagine you're talking to parents, you know, in America who are thinking, I'm interested in getting my kid into an elite school, and I'm interested in my kid being happy. And now you're telling me, I mean, maybe what I could do is have my kid do some kind of work that looks good on a little resume, and maybe they go pick up trash. so that seems to be a major, do you find overcoming these kind of beliefs that are embedded in the culture via the parents? First, you have to convince the parents, or I mean, what is your experience in overcoming those kinds of barriers?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, just from recent examples, right? Like when it comes to getting kids in good colleges, like go for it. If that's what you really want to do and your kid really wants, that's great, but don't do it at the expense of others. And certainly don't do it by cheating, right? I just think there's like just commonly decent ways of doing things. At its base, I would say that's important to think about our motivations and how we're enacting them. And are we doing things in ways that are, you know, genuinely good for ourselves, but also for others, right? So I think in general, it's like about the orientation of thinking about others and not just oneself. I think that's really critical. And, you know, we do actually have some recent data, like from that project I mentioned, State of Caring, that shows, I would say, like optimistically, you know, Americans or in general, people who live here do value caring, right? So maybe as a culture, we're perceived to be more individualistic, but to a large majority of people, it is important to be a caring person. And they do report enacting caring behaviors on a somewhat frequent basis. I can't speak too much more because the report hasn't come out yet. That's a little teaser. You know, so I think that's optimistic. And certainly in our, you know, subsequent research, we really want to dive into that and really understand people's different behaviors and different, different challenges. I do sense that, you know, people may be trading like individual or more interpersonal kind of empathy, like day to day, with like social empathy or like thinking about like broader social issues and causes. So I do think that's a really substantial thing. And I think that's really difficult to wrestle with. And I think in the context of parenting, but when you mentioned about, you know, parents wrestling with over coddling their kids, for example.
Yeah.
Someone, you know, I think I've also read or heard of that as referred to as like the collapse of parenting, right? Like where parents are just kind of letting their kids rule and dictate. And there really isn't any structure or boundaries. And, you know, that might very well be the case in some households. And I think it's also a very, now that I'm a parent, I understand that challenge. And I understand, you know, that most parents, I think we really truly mean well, and we don't want to overcoddle. But hey, when we want our kid to just, you know, stop having a tantrum or stop whining about something, sure, we might give in, right? So I now get that from a perspective of a parent with a two-year-old. But, you know, I will say, so what we really try and practice in our household is like consistency and having some boundaries, right? Like there have to be some boundaries. Like we need to operate within a frame, right? And so like for us, a big one is, you know, we certainly don't hit or kick, right? And we understand our toddler has that impulse. It's very developmentally normal, but we're still going to say, that's not nice. You know, mommy doesn't like getting hurt, you know? And then I act and I generally act hurt. And I am. So most of the time I'm like physically hurt. And, you know, I've come to find that the more I do that, the more my son actually stops, he looks, and now he even comforts me, when he sees that I'm hurt. And I love that. And I think it's come out of that consistency. And when I especially see him, you know, potentially, you know, he's a toddler, so he might like, kind of like slightly push, you know, a kid at a daycare, you know, it's important to express disappointment, right? And this might actually, this might be a somewhat unpopular opinion. But in the literature, you know, when it comes to moral development, disappointment can actually be a really good thing. but it has to be followed up with like true induction and scaffolding, right? So you really need to explain why a certain behavior was wrong, and like what can be done to correct it, right? There needs to be some follow-up, you know, there needs to be accountability and positive consequence. And I think that's important. That might kind of help mitigate the over-coddling, right? If we really focus in on some accountability and consistency, I think slowly we can see positive changes or behavior that, you know, that is more good than bad.
One of the fears with focusing on empathy and moral development may be that, I'm really coming to understand the affect of myself, and then the moral aspect would come in when I'm through that understanding, I'm then gaining, I'm getting closer to like an objective view of morality. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that part of what morality seems to involve moral development is getting outside of myself and saying like, oh, well, when I kick the cat, I don't like to be kicked. And so when I kick the cat, I see when mommy says, you know, we don't kick cats in our house, to say, oh, the cat is an experiencer outside of me. And so using understanding the feelings of the child, but then making that move that you talked about earlier about putting that into action. And so I'm curious about this. You know, seems like there's a balance between having the kids understand their feelings and understand and modeling empathy, and then moving from that to becoming moral people in relation to others. I don't know. Can you speak to that? Is that something that, am I making sense with that question?
No, you are, for sure. And you know, this is such an interesting topic because it took me a while to wrap my head around it, this idea that empathy and morality aren't necessarily the same thing. So I think that's important. So, you know, morality is kind of subjective, right? And I certainly don't want to get into a debate about exactly what is it and what is it not. John Haidt would say it's this interlocking set of values, practices, norms that help us cooperate, right? And suppress or mitigate selfish behavior. And I like that definition because it's kind of like wide and broad enough and it considers different cultures, right? Whereas our more Western culture would kind of focus in more on the welfare, right, of others, right? Morality being about harm, like trying to reduce or mitigate harm. And having a concern for others. And I think that's also a really valid definition. And the reason that morality or, you know, those kind of notions of morality don't necessarily align with empathy, and it kind of goes back to that issue I mentioned earlier of expanding circles of concern, right? So the reason we want to expand our circles is because we can be so partial, right? So how can empathy really be about morality if, you know, we only tend to empathize with those that look like us or seem familiar to us, right? So it's not enough just to pay attention to your friends or your family. It's also important to pay attention, you know, to strangers and or anyone really that you just might not understand, right? Or want to know more about. And I think that's like a really crucial point. You know, to me, really, it's also about like humility or cultural humility, this idea of like acknowledging what it is you don't know, acknowledging that, you know, you can broaden and expand your experiences and your understandings of others. And there's so much to learn, right? So I guess it's also about openness, right? It's about having humility and openness to new experiences. And I think that's where you can maybe seek a little more alignment with this like notion of morality.
I think the question of impartiality, I think you what I was in the long-winded way trying to get at, which is, yeah, you have to, empathy and moral development are not identical. Empathy, of course, is it seems like an integral part of moral development, but there has to be a certain kind of impartiality, like you were saying. If I only have an empathetic response, and this touches on your point about expanding the circle, expanding the moral circle. And, you know, myself as a philosopher and as an ethicist, I think about this, and also as someone who does animal rights, I think about this expanding circle all the time. One of the dangers, at least in the ethical literature, is the dangers of relying solely on empathy is that unless I cultivate empathy for others who are unlike me, right? I might end up just being insulated. Like, example, you know, me as I identify as a white male, I might have, you know, my empathy might extend to people who just look like me, right? So there's moral shortcomings for using empathy. But training children to say, look, that person that might not look like you, but that person has feelings in the same way that we've talked about. We developed this mechanism for us to talk about our feelings. And now we can have this kind of, as you mentioned, an impartial view. And then we can have that circle expand. And as I mentioned before, you know, as someone who does animal rights, it seemed like, you know, at least this is anecdotal, but children are really kind to animals. I mean, they're kind of natural predisposition is to like want to pet animals and snuggle animals. And in the literature on animal rights, we always talk about expanding the circle, right? It's like people thinking like, well, I can be kind to people who look like me. I can be kind to people who don't look like me. And then I could make that next step and go, oh, I can be kind, you know, the dog and the cat. Uh-huh. And so that seems like an integral part of the, nurturing empathy is to make that leap to say we need to expand the circle now, because otherwise we're going to be in this insulated kind of silo where I only have empathetic feelings and reactions to things or people that are like me. And so that part of the project, I think that was your fourth or fifth recommendation. Yeah.
Great memory. Yeah.
Well, thanks. If you can speak more to that, like, so I have this kid and I want to expand the circle. So now what do I, and maybe even practical, like, okay, so here I am, I identify as a white male and I live in a town that's mostly white people. And like, do I like put my kid in the car and go, let's drive into the inner city and see people who don't look like you? Ooh. And now, I mean, that's really, I don't want to go down that route, but what you know, like, and as you said, as a parent, like how do I implement this kind of thing so my kid can have these experiences where they can learn to be empathetic and moral?
Yeah, for sure. I think, great question. And great point. You certainly don't want like superficial or like awkward approaches. Again, you know, you want to be intentional, consistent, organic, natural, right? Like, and I think it comes with practice. So like kind of forcing yourself to do different things or, you know, be exposed to different things, like whether it be through TV or books or podcasts, you know, or museums, right? Like there's all of these opportunities around us for really meaningful engagement with different people and different communities. You know, and like when I was a service learning coordinator way back at Arizona State after getting my master's. And what we did was we worked with college students to really understand like community issues. And then we train them to work with community members, mostly families, kids, you know, for positive development. And in doing that, I remember taking some of the kids to a museum of Indigenous Americans. And it was so fascinating to me the ways in which these kids, you know, observed and commented on what they were seeing. You know, like something is, they were like, wow, they would cut kids' hair because they didn't look, you know, like the white kids. And they would like make these comments, like they were really kind of absorbing what they were seeing in this museum of the way that, you know, Indigenous Americans were treated and kids like them, right? And then they also noticed things that they had in common. And that's actually a really big thing, right? Is exposing and kind of like putting kids and ourselves into different experiences, embracing them, but also then finding commonality. Like finding commonality is so huge. Like in the literature, it's really interesting, right? Like they see these mechanisms of like how to develop, you know, concern for other people. And on one hand, you can do it by, you know, by promoting perspective taking. So really kind of encouraging people to imagine what it must feel like to be in someone else's shoes, right? But for people who are different, or for, yeah, people who just, you know, one can't quite relate to, what's also effective is not just the perspective taking piece, but also similarity, right? Establishing some sort of similarity so that you can then transcend whatever difference and find some common humanity, right? There's a lot of talk about like a common humanity or like a common identity. And I think that's really crucial, you know, and of course, reflecting on the things that you're seeing, you're learning, and being honest about, you know, some of our own biases. You know, so at MCC, we talk a lot about the barriers to empathy, right? And one of them is, you know, the many biases that we hold. And while we're very well aware that many bias trainings are not effective, right, just asking people to confront their biases doesn't quite like work in the long term. We need to find effective ways to talk about and wrestle with our own biases, right? Whether they be about race, gender, whatever, because they certainly get in the way of them being, of seeing people as individuals, right? And for who they are, rather than just as like, you know, members of whatever social group. It's just so important to be able to see people as individuals and as human, rather than categorize them. And, you know, I think that's a big part of it.
Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Paradise Community Guilds, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit paradiseguilds.org or find them on Facebook, or just give them a call at 762-1490. And by Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years in the heart of downtown Chico at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. For more information, call Cotton Party at 893-4923. I'm speaking with Milena Batanova, the Senior Research and Evaluation Manager for Making Caring Common, a program that promotes empathy education at Harvard University. I wanted to touch on something I noticed in looking at the website, which, let me look at the website address. I should be able to, I'll put a link to it in our notes for today's page. The question of justice, and this is a question that we talk about on the program a lot, and that is, so there's, you know, you can think of this distinction as you're nurturing empathy in children and you're having them recognize that there is this, there are these other beings, people who are, you know, experiencing like they are, and we want to nurture empathy and use that as a grounds in some way to promote moral education. And there's a few places, there's a few ways we can go with that. We could say, see this person who is less fortunate, like, for example, you know, a homeless person that you encounter, you're shopping with your kid, and there's a person there who's in rags, and they, you know, they maybe need some help, and, or, you know, if you give them a dollar, I mean, something like that. So there's this notion that empathy can nurture this notion of charity, you know, or you know, of beneficence. And then there's this notion of justice. And I notice on the website, there's a lot of talk of using empathy to make children aware of these kinds of larger, perhaps structural injustices. So if you see, say, a person of color who's homeless, you can think, well, there's a person who is down on his luck and I'm going to help him out. But then you can also say, wait, what are the, there's something not right going, like the sense of injustice, the sense of maybe moral outrage where you're like, the system is not right. And this, and something has to be done about it. And that to me is, that's like, you know, I'm not going to get into like, you know, Kohlberg's hierarchy of, you know, that, but this notion, it seems to me, yeah, it seems to me that that step is, it's a sophisticated step, and to say, no, there's this other thing that's going on. And I was wondering if you can talk about that, because that seems central to the work that you're doing there, that you want to raise awareness of justice in children. So can you speak a little bit to that point?
Yeah, I think so Glenn Manning can probably speak about it far better than I. He is the one who manages our Caring Schools Network. And the Caring School Network basically provides aligned, you know, classroom, school-wide, and parent strategies around empathy and justice. But to do, and I should say, in primarily in middle and high school, right? So we do have strategies for kids ages 7 to 10 on our website, but they cover more like some of the things I've talked about, right? So embracing differences and finding commonality. We have one on using stories, right, to develop empathy and understanding feelings in genuine ways. And then really being able to show empathy through caring, right, and giving parents ideas for what it means to care and what different types of caring there are. So we have those strategies for younger kids, but for the older, yes, we do have these like really nicely sequenced scaffolded strategies that culminate into activities for justice, right? But in order to culminate into those, you know, first we believe it's really important to focus on and build and sustain relationships, right? So at the core, I mean, of all this work, like empathy building is really like, the, you know, prioritizing relationships, and you know, wanting to really see and understand and value other people, right? So the CSN work kind of starts with that phase, and then they go into what they call like learning and practicing, which is really building a lot of the like skills through age-appropriate lessons, like listening deeply, asking thoughtful questions, teaching kids how to, you know, interview others in their school, and especially focusing on kids they might not know very well, right? Or who might look different from them. And then, you know, they go into phase three, right? And the last part of that work is to challenge students to really, you know, identify and analyze injustices, and then be able to, you know, seek justice and fairness. And I, you know, they do that through a few different kind of strategies. There's deconstructing stereotypes, right? So kind of going back to the importance of unpacking and checking our biases. So there's that, there's talking across difference, right? Encouraging students, and again, adults alike, to be able to have constructive disagreement and really be able to talk across the aisle. And then, you know, they really work to transform issues into action, right? So like building on all of these skills and lessons, can they really come to define justice, understand what it means to rely on credible information and objective sources, want to listen to differing perspectives for thinking about and enacting change, and then actually, you know, coming together for a community project, right? And I think they do that like through, they have a series of cool, worksheets and guiding questions. Like, for example, you know, who is involved in the root causes of the problem you want to address? And, who could actually change them, right? And then we give kids examples. So if your topic is about healthcare inequities, right? Because we know there are so many disparities in healthcare, think about who has power to make change. Think about how you can constructively engage them. What kinds of commonalities can you reach? And then go for it. Kind of like a long-winded way to say, you know, the lessons are sequenced and deliberate and all culminate into challenging kids to actually act on the injustices that they analyze.
Well, Milena Batanova, thank you so much for taking your time to share your brilliant insights and really important information about raising empathetic children with our listeners in the Peace and Social Justice Program. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Oh, why you look so sad? The tears are in your eyes. Come on and come to me now. But don't be ashamed to cry. Let me see you through. 'Cause I've seen the dark side too.
At KZFR, we take the health and safety of our community thoughtfully and seriously. To best protect our friends and family in the North State, we as an organization believe that following local guidelines and safety protocols as they relate to COVID-19 can bring us out of the pandemic. That's wearing a mask when necessary, social distancing, receiving a vaccination, and promoting fact-based science. Find where you can get a vaccination today by visiting vaccines.gov, an operation of the Center for Disease Control, or you can call the Butte County Public Health Department at 530-552-4000. KZFR has been doing our part by having our staff, board, and committee meetings on Zoom, educating our programmers on how to broadcast from home, altering pledge drives to reduce foot traffic in the studio, promoting sanitization of our studios and workspaces, and much more. KZFR urges you to do your part to help the station and our community return to a normal life.
I'm joined here via Zoom today by the founder of Chico Friends on the Street, a human rights and homeless advocacy organization, Mr. Patrick Newman. Mr. Patrick Newman is no stranger to these airwaves. Patrick, welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program.
Good to be with you today, Robert.
I should let our audience know that we are conducting this interview via Zoom, and that we're doing this today, Wednesday, November 17th, for broadcast Friday the 19th. Patrick, a lot has been going on as usual. I mean, you know, this is the story of the poverty stricken in Chico, and you know, with every passing week, there's a new development or a regression. But you had the if I may say, you had the misfortune of having to enter into the city council chambers on Tuesdays. I don't know how you have the stomach for that, but my hat is off to you. It's a very noble thing to go in there last night. As I mentioned, we're recording this interview on Wednesday. So last night with the city council meeting, and you went in there as you do, and you get, what do they give you, 2 minutes from the floor or 3 minutes? I forget what it is.
Yeah, the dystopian gift keeps on giving. Living last night some more. The presenter, and we'll get into this a bit later, was allowed unlimited time. And then, you know, the way they structured it, we weren't allowed to directly respond to that. So a bit later, there's this thing called business from the floor. And so you have, you know, 3 minutes. In that 3 minutes, you can try to say something meaningful about, you know, a presentation that was lengthy with many questions from the council. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you're trying to bring a different perspective in a very compressed amount of time. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll call this, you know, this is our, as we do, you know, occasionally, this is like our city council report on the peace and justice.
We had a lengthy presentation by Scott Kennelly, who's the director of Butte County Behavioral Health. And it's important, I think, to notice that Scott Kennelly was invited by Sean Morgan, that Sean Morgan agendized that presentation. And that I think, from what I see, that there's some ideological commonality there between Scott Kennelly and the conservatives on our council, who are approaching poverty very much as a law and order issue versus a social justice, economic justice issue. Because of that, I see our director of behavioral health as being heavily weighted toward looking at the behavior of individuals, and especially people who are identified as, you know, the those having the most impact on the streets as being the problem, and that essentially people in the behavioral health community or the, you know, mental health community are looking for tools to deal with those people. That gets various different amounts of traction depending on how you look at the issues. I don't think everybody in the mental health field all agrees on every element of how Scott Kennelly would approach this. But anyway, if we have time, let's look at how he approaches it. So sorry if there's rattling papers, but I have a copy of his presentation in front of me, and I won't go through all of it, but I'd like to just hit a couple of high points, talk about, or things that jumped out at me, and talk about why they're meaningful.
Pat, if you can give us a summary and connect them to, you and I had conversation earlier through email, connect them to what you see as a sort of missteps. I mean, a lot of these points that in reading through Kennelly's report, one might, if you're not paying attention, you might think, oh, okay, well, this sounds like this is a step in the direction towards part of the solution. But I think the power of the kinds of analysis through the lens of human rights that you do will help people see. I think, you know, these things that on the face of it look like they might be the way to go are actually regressive. So, yeah, what do you have for us from last night?
Yeah, so I think it's good to begin at the beginning, and that is how he begins his presentation. But so there's a sentence: state hospitals were overcrowded and incidents of client abuse, neglect, and mistreatment were common. And this is part of his description of how, and he says this, in 1967, Governor Ronald Reagan signed the Lannerman-Petras Short Act, LPS, which was what we referred to as deinstitutionalization. So that was the time in our history, the early to mid 60s, when we really changed the way that we treat mental illness in California. And I think the rest of the country was closely aligned on this. We went from large institutions to what was in theory a more localized community-based approach to mental illness. And that was made possible by two things, in my opinion. One was that we had pharmaceutical tools that didn't exist before. In other words, a whole array of, you know, drugs that people could use to control mental illness and treat mental illness that didn't exist 20 years before that. We also were moving strongly toward civil liberties and civil rights thinking in the United States at that time. And you see this with the beginning of, you know, the gay rights movement. You see it with in sort of mid stride with the civil rights movement around Martin Luther King's and Malcolm X and that whole historical epic there. And so disabilities, or we're in that mix. There were disability activists who were looking at how to afford better access in a whole array of civil liberties to people with disabilities. So physical disabilities as well as mental disabilities. So in that environment, we deinstitutionalized our large facilities in California. Our state hospital system was reduced in scale considerably. Okay, so those people were put out of the state hospital system. Their treatment and housing was supposed to be picked up at the county level. I think even Scott Kennelly and everyone else who's willing to look at this realistically at all, I'm not sure those on the far right are willing to see this yet, if ever. There was a really horrible failure to pick up the responsibility at the local level and deliver those services in that housing. Year after year, we in our constitution in California, you had to have a two-thirds majority to pass a budget until this was recently changed. This was the last budget item that would come up. And when they were trying to get agreement with two-thirds of the people in at the state legislature, including at this point with needing a two-thirds majority, the voice of those who want to do the least amount of social spending was very strong, and it affected budgets year after year after year. Well, this is the sort of thing that comes up last, and it's the least important in our value system. So year after year after year, we failed to generate, you know, funding for picking this up at the county level. So now, not only do we have that history, but we have a crushing lack of housing along the whole West Coast, and in particular California. So if you look at who gets squeezed in that situation, it's the hundreds of thousands of people who are on the streets who are the least capable of competing for housing. Okay, the problem that I have with Scott's presentation is that there's emphasis put here on the fact that, you know, these hospitals were inhumane, but not nearly enough emphasis put on the fact that that really wasn't the reason why they were closed or limited. The reason why they were closed and limited was because we were trying to move into a new epoch where we could afford people least restrictive environments. That meant moving people who were more or less warehoused in the hospitals into the community where they could live fuller lives with support and guaranteed housing. So a horrible, horrible failure happened. That failure has been, you know, it's 50 years old. It hasn't gotten any better. In fact, it's gotten worse. So that's the first point.
You're tuned to the Peace and Social Justice Program, and we are in conversations today. In conversation today with Patrick Newman, the founder of Chico Friends on the Street, a human rights and homeless advocacy organization here in Chico. I'm your host, Robert Jones. Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Performances, presenting a very Chico Nutcracker on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, December 3rd, 4th, and 5th at Laxon Auditorium. Backed by popular demand, Chico Community Ballet's newly envisioned A Very Chico Nutcracker returns to the stage, infusing the rich history of Chico into the traditional Nutcracker Ballet. Tickets at the University Box Office, 898 6333 or at chicoperformances.com. And by Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920, Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice right here in Chico. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue. For details, see squaredealmattress.com. And Patrick, so one little point was responsibility for mental health services was turned over to the counties. I think there's an interesting parallel here when you think about the history of neoliberal federalism. Let's say, you know, the states' rights versus the, you know, government is this mantra that like government is bad and all, you know, the Reagan era, you know, this whole idea. What is interesting to me is there are parallels circling back to the protected class idea. There are parallels in the history of race, legal protections for specifically for blacks in the United States, and how it took the Civil Rights Act, it took the 1964 Act signed by LBJ. So it took taking the power out of the localities, municipalities, counties, and states, and moving it to a more centralized source to implement, you know, what we see as policies of justice. And so I think there's an interesting parallel when we have, with the Reagan administration, the handing over of the mental health services to the counties, and then each county, depending on where you are in what state, I mean, even within the state of California, right? Los Angeles County and Butte County are going to have different ideologies and different implementations of policies.
That's a really interesting point, because I think Lanternman Petras was really a progressive piece of legislation, even though Ronald Reagan signed it. I mean, all of the civil liberties protections that were, you know, encoded in law at that point came from Lanternman Petras, and the idea of affording people more liberty was a progressive direction. What I think Ronald Reagan saw in that was we can cut cost by deinstitutionalizing people, because the California state mental hospital system was expensive. It was extensive and it was expensive. And it had a lot of state employees working there, which for me as a socialist doesn't sound bad, but to someone like Ronald Reagan, who wants to cut government any way possible and eliminate government jobs, he saw that as a way to do this. And in fact, it could be argued maybe that the authors were a bit naive, because I think their intentions were good, but I think the degree to which our state legislature would fail to follow through with the funding to support this at the county level, which was going to be overseen by the state, by the way. It wasn't like counties could do whatever they wanted. There were all kinds of restrictions on what counties could do. But counties can't do anything if they don't have funding. So what happened over the next decades was that we had, like I said, budget after budget after budget, where this was not well funded. And so a lot of what Lanternman Petras could have achieved was not achieved on the progressive level. So it's an interesting mix of forces there. I think the degree to which the sort of craven, corrupt, duplicitous approach of the California legislature on this, that's the thing that I think that they were probably naive about. Mm-hmm. We really did have decade after decade of miserable infighting over funding any kind of social services in California. And one thing people should realize is that parallel to what we're talking about right now, we did set up a regional center system, and that was set up specifically to address the needs of people who are developmentally disabled, which classically was 70 IQ or below. That system has been well funded. It's worked very effectively. I worked in one of the what's called the vendorized agencies that got money through the regional center system to do independent living skills training. If you took that model, which basically was, hey, can you do an assessment, you work with someone who can live independently. You find them an apartment, you go and you sort of coach them and make and work with them to be successful living independently. If we took that very same model and applied it to mental illness, brain injuries, and everything else that's fallen through the cracks, we wouldn't be where we are right now, but we didn't do that. We were able to create a reasonably well-funded approach to developmental disabilities that we did not do with mental illness. So, and that did come out of Petrus, or it came out of Lanerman, because most of the people that I worked with would have been in mental hospitals in California 20 or 30 or 40 years before I knew them. So, we've made huge strides in some ways, but obviously the system is terribly, terribly flawed. And we have to, we can't talk about this without talking about the predatory approach that we take to housing in general in this kind of capitalism we see in America today, where housing is not a human right. Housing is not something we see as a necessity for everybody that we're going to try to distribute fairly or justly. It's a game that's played where people come into the housing markets for one purpose and one purpose only, and that's to maximize profits. And so this has not helped us in terms of generating lots of affordable housing for people. And we're seeing the crisis that's resulted from that.
And if I may, Patrick Newman of Chico Friends on the Street, in looking at the ACLU report that I was referencing, and as I mentioned, for those of you who are interested, I will put a link on this episode page at kzfr.org to that report. You can check it out yourself. One of the things that they mention, Patrick, is the campfires of 2018, post-campfire, which is, it was 3 years ago, November, and the influx of the figure they put in that report is about 53,000 people came into Chico. I've always heard of like 30, but anyway, let's say 30 to 50,000 increase in a population of less than 100,000. So you have demand, skyrocketing, relative to the population and the amount of homes available. And then to bring up another little bugaboo of my own, I'm sure I'm not alone in this, is that now we have a lot of the Airbnb people in town. So, not only do we not have enough physical housing for demand, we also have, because of the supply-demand relation, we have the cost of rentals is pretty high, the highest I've ever seen in my 13 years in Chico. And then to diminish the actual number of units available, we have Airbnb. So that comes in, that causes the shortage to go up, then that causes the prices to go up. So it seems like the only people who can live in Chico are people who can afford to buy a house. You can't really afford to rent. Maybe if you're a student, you get subsidies, but the average person has a difficult time unless you have a roommate, which, anyone who knows anyone who lives in San Francisco who's not a millionaire, when you live in the Bay Area, you have to have a roommate or you have to have roommates. You can't, if you're a teacher, for example, at, say, San Francisco City College or Cal State, San Francisco State, you can't live in San Francisco on that salary unless you have roommates. So my point is that this is a confluence of circumstance from the campfire, from Airbnb, from the economy, as you mentioned, this kind of predatory capitalist notion of housing as being some kind of prize you win if you play your cards right, the wealth inequality. So this is a recipe for disaster. It's a kind of perfect storm of leading to desperation. And I don't really see any, as you mentioned, Patrick, I don't really see any way out of this thing in the near future. I don't see things getting better in Chico. I know that there's a movement in Chico to have Chico be attractive to the Bay Area tech crowd, who they want to come out to Chico. I mean, this is the kind of thinking that's going on in the city. To solve the problems here is to go down the very same path, the race to the bottom strategy, which is let's have as little housing available to people who can afford it. And instead of thinking, well, what are we going to do with the people who can't afford it? Who's going to buy the stuff in the stores down? Hear about the businesses downtown. Well, who's going to afford to live here? So anyway, these strategies are so, in my humble estimation, and you know more about this than I do, Patrick Newman, but these strategies are, they're back ass word, if you will. I mean, they are just the, if you could make a plan to make housing worse in a city like Chico, this is the perfect plan to do that. This, the way that the city is set out and you know, the way it's built. So I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of housing, something I've talked about before, but housing per capita, square footage per capita is double what it was when around the time that you and I were born. So we don't have any less square footage per person. We have worse distribution than ever. The average size house built in the 1950s was less than 1,000 square feet. Now it's closer to 2,500 square feet. So it's 2.5 times larger while, you know, millions of people are experiencing some combination of housing insecurity or homelessness. Wow. I mean, that's not a resource scarcity issue. That's a resource distribution issue. And all of our policies and culture and values have led us to this place where, you know, somehow, you know, anyway, so you can see where I'm going with that. But yes, you're right. I mean, there's a whole bunch of different elements happening here. But back to the square one, which is, you know, let's just go back to Scott's presentation. What he's bringing forth out of all this is he's basically saying, like, well, we deinstitutionalized. People are now on the streets. There's a kind of tendency to think that, oh, okay, well, now we need to reinstitutionalize to get them back off. And so he talks about where Lannerman Petras leads or directed us in terms of civil liberties and protections for people who have mental illness. So there's a whole bunch of legislation there that led to the 5150, which required that, you know, holds could only be of a certain length. There had to be review. There has to be, that you can't just grab someone off the street and institutionalize them because we now have we have protections in the law that make it very difficult to do that. Well, for someone who's looking at homelessness through this lens of, well, there are people in our downtowns who are wandering around in rags and they're causing problems and they commit petty crimes and we see them drinking in public. And Scott Kennelly refers to this through a person who he calls John, and John's behaviors, that person becomes the point of the spear. Like, this is the person that we're going to look at first in this context of housing injustice. So why? Well, because this is the person that's causing us the most problems. This is the person that's the most visible. And this is the person who has a raft of disabilities, some combination of mental illness, et cetera, that, could be taken off the streets by force if we didn't have Lannerman Petras in the way. So the idea here is to, you know, and he said so, lobby, you know, our right-wing assemblyman James Gallagher and ask him to help get legislation through to strip some of these protections out of Lannerman Petras so that our city, you know, and the person who invited Scott Kennelly to the council meeting, Sean Morgan, can use a more robust, muscular law and order approach to dealing with the most incorrigible people. Well, what's the problem with that? The problem is that it doesn't, first of all, it erodes away rights that people who had, you know, who are thinking pretty clearly put together for good reason without really looking at why they're there. And it puts the onus on the most visible element in the homeless population that's the most disturbing to us without thinking what generated this in the first place. What created the symptom? What's the cause of the symptom? The cause of the symptom is a 50-year failure to provide housing and services for people. So when we isolate John and look at all of his antisocial behaviors and make that the focus of our attention, what we're doing is we're escaping, in my opinion, our responsibility to look at really to do a deep look into why we are where we are and what we could really do so that In other words, we're not asking the question. John, in his example of this person, John, is 56 years old. That's about the length of time all this has been going on. We're not looking at, you know, where John might be today if we were Finland or some other country where we provide housing and services for people. John could be in a very different place. Maybe John wouldn't be wandering the streets in rags, you know, smoking meth and doing all these things that they find so objectionable, because the system that produces John, who has schizophrenia and could benefit from a lifetime of help, somehow we're not going to go back and do the moral inventory that it would take to look at how it got here. So I see it all dovetailing together, where it offers people who don't want to look at our failure, and this is, I'm going to say this is on the right, to provide the kind of social services that we needed all these years. We're going to just skip over that and go to, well, how do we isolate this particular and most offensive, you know, fragment of the homeless population and start pounding on them by, first of all, taking away their civil liberties and then, you know, putting them back into some kind of institution against their will.
That's Patrick Newman of Chico Friends on the Street in conversation today about the various issues with the homeless crisis in Chico, and focusing specifically on last night's city council meeting in which Scott Kennelly gave a presentation. And we're sort of trying to go through some of the major points.
I would like to go through really quickly what Scott Kennelly is saying John's options are, just to see how honest this thing is. I will do it fast. So he goes through 5 points and he titles it, what are the options to help John? Okay, so outpatient treatment is the first one, available for free or low cost throughout the county. Right off the bat, outpatient treatment for someone who's living in a tent. Well, even if that outpatient treatment does exist, which I tend to doubt to any significant degree, you're talking about dealing with an addiction while living homeless. This is a very difficult, there's people who have every resource in the world who are battling addictions and having a very difficult time. Trying to do that on the streets is a no-go. So that's not honest. He says housing assistance available for those open to services. Housing assistance available for those open to services. You got to be kidding me. If there was housing assistance available to everybody who was open to it, we'd have hundreds of thousands of people off the streets today. The reason we don't have them off the streets is because there is no housing available. That's just a fact. Outreach and engagement, relationship building, motivational interviewing through street outreach. What the hell is that? You go and interview someone on the street and you give them a motivational talk. There's not a single person on the street that listens to that kind of stuff and takes it seriously. So then with these failing, And it's back on John, because John's not taking these things that don't exist. This is so, I don't know, I'm sorry, it's just profoundly dishonest. When these interventions are not successful, there are two more restrictive options. One, hospitalization. Two, incarceration. So everything defaults back to hospitalization and incarceration, which is really comes back to my fourth principle, which is containment of the poor. So that when services are resisted, services that really are phantom services, you can say, well, the person failed to take us up on all this that we're offering them. Therefore, we can justify, you know, putting them into some kind of impoundment. And you can do it on a medical basis, or you can do it on a criminal basis. But the bottom line is, with John, that's sort of the direction that John's headed. It's no coincidence that in this report there are many references to drug laws and our criminalization codes, which, and in both cases, Scott Kennelly thinks we need to bring back more punitive approaches to drug use and also more punitive approaches to low-level crime, so that really a very clear law and order argument there as a way to deal with mental illness, which is spooky. The second part, I would agree for sure that there are people who need hospitalization. People probably would like to think that I just have this blanket crazy idea that there's nobody out there that could benefit from hospitalization, or that at some point being a danger to themselves or others would need to be held, and perhaps held for a long time, because life on the streets is simply not going to work for them for whatever medical reason it's not working. That's a separate issue from whether people who are on the streets are broken down and untreated and traumatized by experiencing housing deprivation and now beginning to exhibit symptoms of severe mental illness and a whole raft of other things that comes with that. So we should be careful when we talk about, well, yeah, let's start hospitalizing people, when we don't recognize that the reason we might be hospitalizing them is because we failed to help them maintain any sort of life experience that would not lead to a complete breakdown. Most of us can't exist without sleep. Most of us can't, well, we can exist, but we can't maintain our sanity without sleep. We can't maintain our sanity without some kind of security. Well, people with any kind of mental illness that are put on the streets without, you know, with sleep deprivation, lack of security, constant hunger, exposure to the elements, those things are going to exacerbate any kind of mental illness and drive people to a point where, okay, now look, you just created a self-fulfilling prophecy. You drove this person to a point where, wow, it looks like they need to be hospitalized. Well, is that something that could have been prevented with, you know, a Lloyd Pendleton approach to housing first for each of these people? Of course it could have been. So we kind of conflate all this together, and it's like we're driving people off the edge, and then people who are most in crisis are somehow seen as, all of a sudden now they're going to be treatable by forced treatment and put in some kind of institution because of their behaviors. We're not owning the whole picture at all when we do that.
I'm in conversation with Patrick Newman, the founder of Chico Friends on the Street, and as we head into the last minutes of the show, I wanted to pick up on a couple of things. First, lest I forget, I want to direct people to the Monday, November 15th issue of the Chico Enterprise Record, in which journalist Mike Weber has a piece on the Chico Friends on the Street and on Patrick Newman. It's titled Homeless Advocacy Group Distributes Supplies Through the Winter. I thought it was a really nice piece. I want people to check that out. And I will also link to that piece on the episode page of this program. And Patrick, I wanted to also just to circle back to this issue of, I see it as a kind of, I mean, there are plenty of historical precedents for this, even within the history of poverty and the criminalization of poverty. It's a kind of pathologizing. It's a pathologizing of poverty. And this parallel came into my mind. If you know, the late 19th and early 20th century upper middle class, the sort of upper middle class women who were suffering from what psychiatrists called melancholia, right? I mean, so here you are, you're basically forced to stay home, and you might have other careers or something you want to do, but your depression or your malaise is sort of pathologized, and it's like we institutionalize you. That's the solution, instead of looking at issues of, you know, a choice or autonomy. And I think there's a parallel here when we have a kind of a problem that we either A, we don't know how to deal with, a social problem, or something that we don't want to deal with, we pathologize it, we turn it into some kind of illness, and we see hospitalization, right? And so there's a long history going back to, you know, Victorian England and just the kind of Dickensian descriptions of the pathology of the poor, and they have to be put in workhouses or hospitals or insane asylum, right? So I know that people think this is 2021 and we're advanced, but I just don't see this idea of hospitalization as actually being discussed on the floor of the city council in 2021 as separate from the context and the history of the demonization and the pathologizing of poverty. It's just kind of mind blowing, Pat. I mean, I got to say, like, are we still doing this? Like, this is where this is proffered as a solution. I'm just like scratching my head in disbelief.
Yeah, it's interesting that you brought up Dickens, because it's like we've got a couple pathologies going on here. What I've seen in California in my lifetime, one of the major pathological elements is greed. And I think that greed expresses itself through legislation and the way that our economy works. And so that's a pathology we don't talk about. We say greed, you know, there's what's that film where Michael Douglas says greed is good.
Wall Street, is that it?
Yeah, Wall Street. So,
well, no, Pat, it's not only do we not pathologize as we should greed, we valorize. Greed is, that's the solution to all our social problems, right? So it's right. It's well, not even close to pathology.
Ayn Rand and objectivism and, you know, infecting everything, which is quite a bit the core of what's happening here. And we're seeing the manifestations of years and years and years of that kind of, I don't know, really sloppy and corrupt thinking. And so it ends up on the street. So what's the response? You know, and maybe this is a bit, you know, abstract, but instead of doing a moral inventory and looking at like, well, geez, how do we end up with this kind of dysfunction? We paper it over by making the victim the perpetrator. So John, who's the victim of all this, in my opinion, becomes the perpetrator because he smokes pot in public. And he's offending our sensibilities. So it's really upside down and backwards thinking. And it's unfortunately pretty damn popular.
Very sad. Very sad. Well, Patrick, another hour. We've reached the end of the hour. Again, have we solved any problems? I don't know if we've done that, but hopefully we've shed some light on some of the missteps that the city is taking. There are too many. This can be a regular 1 hour a day series on the missteps the city is taking with regard to poverty. But Patrick Newman, if people who want to reach you, they want to reach out to Chico Friends on the Street, you are there. Chico Friends on the Street is there every Sunday at the plaza. Well, now that we didn't even touch on the ice skating rink, but adjacent to the plaza every Sunday at noon, we have the morning breakfasts Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 9 a.m. Patrick, how can people get in touch with Chico Friends on the Street if they're interested in getting involved?
Yeah, the best way is to come out at any of those times. Sunday at noon, like Robert said, across the street from the plaza now, as long as the plaza's fenced off, along with the toilets that people depend on, a whole other subject. Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 9 o'clock, come out and meet with our coffee group. I'm there on some of those days, not all of them. Right now, because winter's coming, I'm there on most Sundays, and I see this as a time, this will be my sixth winter, when we really need to resupply people with materials they need for survival on the streets. People can't carry all their winter gear all summer long. They have nowhere to store it. So every winter you end up re-upping people in sleeping bags and tarps and everything else. And Robert, I appreciate all the help that you've given us on that too. So that's the task at the moment, along with food and just being in solidarity with people and standing with them. I can be reached at chicofriendsonthestreet@gmail.com. Feel free to send an email if you want more information. I'm happy to talk about it.
Well, that's great. Patrick Newman, again, thank you for taking the time to share your insights here on the Peace and Social Justice Program. I'm sure we'll be having you back. Thanks for the noble work you do for the community, the heroic work you do for the most, in Chico at least, the most demonized population, those who are suffering poverty and the unhoused. Patrick Newman, we'll have you, well, I'm sure we'll talk to you again in the future, but again, thank you for being on the program.
Robert, thanks a lot, and I really appreciate you offering this forum so many times. It's been really important. Thank you.
Nice little Crazy Fingers fadeaway. Thank you, Robert, once again for a very important peace and social justice here on Community Radio 90.1 KZFR Chico, worldwide at kzfr.org. And of course, on that smarty phone you got in your pocket. My name's Ray. It's time for Playing Dead, Music of the Grateful Dead, every Friday afternoon from 1 till 3. I want to thank Bill DeBlanc, my partner in crime here. He's going to be covering the Thanksgiving shift on next Friday. So thank you for making that switch with me, Billy. I really appreciate it. We want to thank our underwriters, and we'll get right to the show. We're going to Duke University. That's right, the campus of Duke University. On April 12th, 1978. Nice Betty Board taping, recording, so you know it's going to be a nice quality show. Alrighty, we want to thank Baird Roofing Company for a hole in your roof or a whole new roof. Baird Roofing Company has been serving Butte County for more than 30 years. Whether it's an existing structure or new construction, Baird Roofing has got you covered. More information at bairdroofing.com. Or at 342-1631. And by Lassen Traditional Cider, made in Chico and offering a number of varieties from dry ciders to farmhouse to heirloom and elderberry and pomegranate. Made only from fruit from Northern California orchards and pressed in season. Lassen Traditional Ciders are available in local stores, bars, eateries, online, and in their tasting room at 643 Ether Avenue, Suite 52 in Chico. Details at LassenCider.com, on Facebook and Instagram, and at 593-0554. Entler Road, there it is, Entler Road. You know where it is, south on 99. Yeah, I don't know who made all those words up. Anyway, let's get to the show. Thanks for tuning in. Hit us up on our Facebook page, Playing Dead on KZFR, like set list. Had a bunch of nice posts this week about Grateful Dead-related stuff. So scroll it out. Please share it. Throw a like on there. Get you the shout-out. And let's see. Right over the 1 o'clock number. We're going to skip the first couple tunes and jump right into the show. Again, we're going to Duke University campus in Durham, North Carolina, 4/12/1978. This was about 10 weeks after my first Dead show. Kaboom.